Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to the California Council for the Humanities Forum on Democracy and the Culture of Civic Conversation, and to the panel, An Engaged Society. Let me introduce myself, I guess, as the moderator. There, of course, is nothing moderate about me. And what we'll do is we'll start out here with Robert, who will give a brief summary of the role of African Americans in bringing about an engaged society in this country. And Donna will then deal with the history of women, and then Cruz, the emerging Latino demographic, if you will. I am Ian Masters, a BBC. A BBC-trained broadcast journalist, commentator, author, screenwriter, and documentary filmmaker. He's the host of Background Briefing, a radio program which covers politics, foreign policy, and national security issues on KPFK 90.7 FM here in Southern California. He also hosts the UCLA Hammer Forum, which features timely subjects and thought-provoking guests addressing the current social and political issues. He also blogs at the Huffington Post, which doesn't mean a lot. And at ianmasters.com, by the way. Let me just make a brief couple of remarks, just in the sense that I'd like to provoke a discussion here, and also, to some extent, summarize what's already been said in the previous panels here. Two recent traumatic events have shaped our politics, economics, and culture in a way that could not be more counterproductive or counterintuitive to my mind. But we are nevertheless living with this unfortunate self-inflicted reality. The near-death economic meltdown on Wall Street has resulted in Main Street punishing itself while Wall Street is richer and greedier than ever. With the country deep in recession, most Americans have bought into the notion that all of us except Wall Street have to tighten our belts. Apparently, dealing with the deficit is more important than stimulating the economy. And although Economics 101 tells us that creating more jobs, not more unemployment, is the way to recover from the Wall Street-created recession. The other disastrous overreaction was the 9/11 attack, in response to which we line up at airports with our shoes off and waste trillions of our treasure and the lives of our young men and women and countless others chasing a few hopeless fanatics in caves somewhere in an endless war that bin Laden has goaded us into. At the time when the Iraq War fever swept the land and the media celebrated shock and awe, the novelist John le Carré remarked that America was going through another period of temporary madness. Meanwhile, we are dumb and getting dumber, and as the political madness becomes institutionalized, thanks to the recent Supreme Court decision that allows our politics to become totally captured by money, with candidates and issues almost irrelevant, and the mainstream media the main beneficiaries of a broken system they profit from as billions are spent on negative advertising, the notion of a civil society becomes dim and distant. And in spite of the preamble to the Constitution that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, there is no consensus on what is true anymore. Conservatives get informed by Fox, liberals by MSNBC, and Christians by Christian TV, and so on. Americans shop for their own reality online, and while one political party, the Republicans, does not believe in facts or data, the other, the Democrats, appear to be overwhelmed by data as they struggle to find a coherent narrative. It would seem that we are either in a permanent decline or we are witnessing a political tantrum, trapped like helpless children in a dysfunctional marriage as the parents blame each other for everything that is going wrong. With the Republican presidential candidates now getting warmed up to run in 2012, we can expect most of them to join Sarah Palin, as Mike Huckabee just has, in embracing the Bertha Kenyon Mau Mau Muslim nonsense. Get ready for the next 2 years of a celebration of ignorance, while the so-called liberal elite, meaning anyone with an education, is denigrated. The most powerful political force in America appears to be the Tea Party. Is this the only political movement that speaks for the real Americans? One might ask then, where are the unreal Americans? Are they the new silent majority, cowed into submission because a political savior has not delivered us to the promised land? Has the tide of hope and change receded into an oily dead sea of apathy and despair? The writer and social critic Susan Jacoby calls this the age of American unreason. And although social media is a tool that is freeing a new generation in the Middle East, we appear to be becoming prisoners of technology. Are we entering an information age in which we will have access to everything and knowledge of nothing? Will the technology of promise become an enabler of further unreason? Or, to parody Winston Churchill's homage to the Battle of Britain, never before in the field of human history has so much been communicated by so many about so little. So let us now forge ahead and find a way to enable and engage society at this forum on democracy and the culture of civic conversation. Let me introduce our first speaker, who is Robert C. Smith. He's an honors graduate of the University of California, Berkeley. He also holds a master's degree from UCLA and a PhD from Howard. He's the author or co-author of scores of articles and essays and 11 books, including a leading textbook in the field, American Politics and the African-American Quest for Universal Freedom, and the Encyclopedia of African-American Politics. Conservatism and Racism and Why in America They Are the Same, Why in America They Are the Same, was published last fall by the State University of New York Press, and The Politics of Ethnic Incorporations and Avoidance, The Elections and Presidencies of John F. Kennedy and Barack H. Obama, will appear next year. It compares the Catholic, Irish, and the African-American experiences and the election of the first Catholic and the first African-American president. Robert C. Smith.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and in this conversation. I'm going to talk a little bit about the African-American experience in the franchise. The African-American case is the paradigmatic case for the process of exclusion and then incorporation of subordinated groups into the political process. The Dred Scott case, the infamous Supreme Court case that declared African Americans had no rights under the Constitution except those the people in power might choose to confer on them. And of course, they chose not to confer the right to vote. And as a result of the Civil War, the Congress enacted and the states ratified the 14th Amendment, which conferred on African American citizenship, reversing the Dred Scott case. But of course, and this is very important, citizenship does not necessarily confer the right to vote. So the 15th Amendment was subsequently passed, which conferred on African-American men the right to vote. This, of course, at the time created an enormous controversy and led to really the first break between what was then a coalition between the feminist movement, or the women's movement, and the African-American movement, because white women at the time objected. White women, largely racist and white supremacists, rejected the idea that their inferiors, black men, should be given the right to vote before them. That right to vote was conferred in the late 1860s, and African American men exercised that right with enormous enthusiasm for about a decade and a half, and during the so-called Reconstruction period. And then that vote was taken away. It was taken away initially through terrorism, open white terrorism, intimidation, economic intimidation, and then a variety of legal stratagems, literacy test, poll tax, grandfather clause, white primary. And certainly an emotional process that by the beginning of the last century, virtually all African American peoples in the southern states had been disenfranchised. Late 1870s, about 70-80% of African Americans in Louisiana, one of the states that kept registration records by race, about 70% of African Americans were voting. By the beginning of the century, that had been reduced to less than 10%. My mother was born in 1903, and she died in 2004. And the first election that she felt free to vote in was 1972. That was a consequence of the enactment of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, which came about as a consequence of one of Dr. King's great crusades, the Selma March, and which you Bloody Sunday and that kind of thing. And the Congress shortly thereafter enacted the Voting Rights Act, which within a relatively short period of time enfranchised most African Americans in the southern states. The Congress and the courts then became concerned that although people might have the right to vote, they might have no one to vote for. So the courts began to interpret the Voting Rights Act as requiring that persons be given the opportunity to vote for a candidate of their choice. That was the language. On the assumption that in the South, whites were very, very reluctant to vote for blacks. And so in order for black people to have a vote that was meaningful, you had to give them the opportunity to vote for, quote, a candidate of their choice, assuming that would be someone of their own ethnic origins. So the Voting Rights Act was reinterpreted by the courts and eventually codified by the Congress, requiring that legislative districts be drawn in such a way that they have a majority of African Americans, on the assumption that that was the only way they could win legislative seats. This principle was later extended to Latinos as well. So as a result of that, you have fairly complete inclusion of African Americans in the formal process of voting in elections. I should note, however, that there is a problem with respect to felony disenfranchisement. About 13% of African American peoples have been nationally have been disenfranchised because they have been convicted of a felony. A principle of American democracy, of any democracy, is that all adult citizens should have the right to vote for persons who enact laws that they have to obey. It is no accident that these felony disenfranchisement laws were enacted and have their most egregious effect in the states of the Old South, and something in Alabama, Mississippi, something like a third of African American men cannot vote because they have
Florida.
Florida is particularly pertinent here. So that is a lingering problem. Congressman Conyers had introduced legislation to at least grant to persons in federal elections who have served their terms the right to vote. That, of course, went nowhere, even under his chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee. The Ninth Circuit, I think it's the Ninth Circuit, has ruled, however, that that disenfranchisement has such a disparate impact on African Americans that it constitutes a violation of the Voting Rights Act. So I suspect that case will go to the Supreme Court at some point. It is almost certain the Supreme Court will reverse the Ninth Circuit, as it usually does, because I would guess that there is a majority now on the Supreme Court that, if the proper case comes before it, would in fact rule portions of the Voting Rights Act itself unconstitutional. So we're there, but we are not completely there. And there's just some barriers that are there and some barriers that might in fact reappear as a result of current Supreme Court thinking about the Voting Rights Act.
Well, thank you, Robert. Let me introduce Donna Shealy, who is a lecturer at the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. Prior to joining the UCI faculty, she was a research scholar in the Center for the Study of Women at UCLA, where she also taught in the history and political science departments. Shealy teaches courses in the U.S. Supreme Court, civil rights and civil liberties, American constitutional history, gender and law, crime and gender, family law, constitutional law, and the American legal system. Previously, Shealy served as the executive director of the California Supreme Court Historical Society and was a member of the State Bar of California Committee on Women in Law. She also served as a law clerk for the Honorable Alfred T. Goodwin, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in 1997 and 1998. Shealy holds a J.D. and a Ph.D. in jurisprudence from Bolt Hall at UC Berkeley.
Thank you. And it's a real pleasure to be here today and to serve on this very esteemed panel. I want to talk a bit about the arc of history of women's engagement in politics, which you might think doesn't have much of a story prior to maybe the 19th Amendment or a little bit before that. But actually, we can go all the way back to our nation's founding and a little bit afterwards, where there was developed a sort of a trend that historians have dubbed Republican motherhood. And that was a way women argued for a distinctive role for women in the political sphere as mothers, because they were raising the next generation of political participants. But at that time, we start to see the formation of a tension that continues to exist today. And scholars have dubbed this, on the one hand, difference feminism, in other words, an argument for women's place in the political sphere and involvement based on the differences of women and what they bring to the table. And on the other side, a sameness feminism that is really more based in notions of human rights and that women are entitled to the same rights as men. So focus on the sameness between men and women. And this tension, as I say, has persisted until today. Oddly enough, women were involved in partisan politics sort of in the heyday of the Jacksonian era, even though they couldn't vote. Their partisanship was often defined by the partisan allegiances of their families, their birth families, or families by marriage. But they had some interesting involvement that you wouldn't necessarily predict for people who were not able to vote. But this sort of coalesces in, and women's political involvement coalesces in 1848 in the Seneca Falls Convention in upstate New York, a very lovely little town. My family and I had an opportunity to visit there a few years ago. And that they've attempted to preserve where these women came together, women and men, to create a document called the Declaration of Sentiments that in many ways echoes the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Sentiments is etched on what we would call a water wall at the museum there. And my husband, who's a businessman and not terribly involved in women's history, was reading some of this for the first time. And this is post 9/11 that we're there, and his eyes get wide and he says, "Oh my gosh, today these women would be arrested as terrorists." And I had never thought about that. I teach the Declaration of Sentiments year in, year out, and I had to say, you know, with a fresh eyes on this, you're right. It was a very radical document. Well, out of the Seneca Falls Convention comes the suffrage movement, and this is the period of time that historians have dubbed first wave feminism. And the suffrage movement is very much tied to the Civil War and Reconstruction, and as Robert has told us, the pushing of women out of that reform movement, and the names that we generally associate with the suffrage movement: Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stone, and definitely divisions in the movement about what was the appropriate strategy, and really a launching in the 19th century, in the second half of the 19th century, into two movements, one which sought the vote state by state, because at that time states were really the arbiters of election rules, or seeking the vote on a national level through a constitutional amendment. And interestingly, during this time, women started to run for office. And today, very noted women's historians who ought to know better, you'll see them make the statement, once women got the vote, and they're generally looking at 1920 and the 19th Amendments, once women got the vote, they could run for office. And nothing could be less true. And if you were to remind those historians about none other than Victoria Woodhull, they'd probably have to go like that. But indeed, women ran for office during this postbellum period, and ironically ran for offices that they themselves could not vote for. So here they were running to be and occasionally won. On the national level, Victoria Woodhull running for president, and then in the 1880s, Belva Lockwood running for president. Certainly the process was a bit different back then in terms of parties and voting and so on, but also women running on the local level, and in California, indeed, by statute, women could run for school offices. The legislature gave them that right. They could not vote for themselves. So if you can imagine a candidate running for office and not being able to vote for herself. And so we do have women winning election on the local level. The Western states were the first states to grant women suffrage. A lot of debate about why that was so. California was not one of those states, but newer states coming into the Union. And that's really where we see a lot of the firsts in terms of women elected to office. Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. Utah was in and then out of giving women the vote. So we see some of those victories early on. And the suffrage movement sort of morphs in the 20th century. More middle class women get involved, and difference feminism really takes the front seat on this, and this notion of women should have the right to vote simply because they are human beings sort of recedes into the background, and women become very involved in progressive era politics. And in fact, the term, echoing this term of Republican motherhood, the term that comes forward during this period is something called municipal housekeeping, and a lot of focus on the local level of cleaning up politics and bringing in social programs and so on, and this idea that women were particularly suited to advance those issues, particularly if they involve children. These are middle-class women. These are educated women, definitely a force of women's increased participation in higher education. And also, it is a result of an economic system that is, fairly good. These are women with a fair amount of leisure time that get involved in politics. So this all culminates in the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920. And to really drive the point home, we need to realize this is a 72-year movement. This is probably the longest social movement in U.S. history in terms of start to finish achieving the goal. And we sometimes lose sight of the tremendous amount of time it took for women to have the vote guaranteed nationally. Well, the 19th Amendment allowed sameness feminists and difference feminists to come together, and that coalition splits apart afterwards. We get the founding of a nonpartisan organization called the League of Women Voters, which continues to exist today and do very, very good work. And in addition, one of the more radical suffragists, Alice Paul, launches the sameness feminist movement on the path of an equal rights amendment. So this starts in the 1920s, although we often don't think of the history of that movement being so long. And an interesting thing about the equal rights movement as we look from the 1920s forward is from a partisan political standpoint, it was the Republican Party that supported the ERA, and it mostly came from the small percentage of professional women in the workforce where it turned out protective labor legislation was infringing on their advancement. When we think of the Equal Rights Amendment more in the 1960s and 70s, we associate that with the Democratic Party. Oftentimes, the decades of the 30s, 40s, and 50s are referred to as the doldrums with regard to women's political involvement. There aren't a lot of firsts during this period in terms of women getting elected. We have a lot of those in the late 19th and into the 20th century associated with the 19th Amendment. Things do kind of die down, but as all historians know, you just have to scratch under the surface a little bit and you will see the activity. And so on the surface, it looks like women aren't doing too much politically during this period, but in many ways, the groundwork is being laid for the 1960s, where we have a bursting forward of what we call second wave feminism. And this is very much associated with civil rights movements more generally. race, ethnicity in the United States, although the women's movement has distinctive features as well. And we have the final push for the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. Things look like they're going along swimmingly and then coming to a screeching halt in the mid-70s. And perhaps one can say that that experience then predicts the Reagan Revolution of 1980 and forward. So the Equal Rights Amendment is ultimately not ratified, but on the other side, there are many advances that women gain in the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of interpretation of the 14th Amendment, where the argument could be made that that there was less of a need for the Equal Rights Amendment, although there's been some interesting revival of interest in having an Equal Rights Amendment in our Constitution. In 1992, we had something called the Year of the Woman. Political historians are still debating the import of that, the effect of that. We did see an increase in women at office holders at the national level and then all the way down. And one of the things you may remember is during the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings with Anita Hill, that the Senate Judiciary Committee was all white male. I don't think there were any women in the Senate at that time. Women are elected to the Senate, and it's no surprise Dianne Feinstein ends up very early on with a seat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I believe she still holds. But it is the case that women's election to office, especially at the national level, has stalled out at the 16-17% level, and that certainly is troubling to those who would like to see more in office. One of the things we see from the 80s forward, 90s into today, is a gender gap in voting that did not emerge in the wake of the 19th Amendment, was predicted but didn't. And it would be fair to say that the gender gap since 1980 has elected every president from there on out, except a couple of elections where there was gender gaps, both men and women. And in those two elections where there was gender gaps, both men and women, the Republican presidential candidate won. Where there's a gender gap, male or female, but not the other side, that gender gap has predicted the winner. So it's hard to ignore gender and voting more modernly. And we historians today say that we're in a period of third wave feminism, although we disagree on how we define that. I won't even attempt to now. And I suppose that the question that we're left with as we look towards the future is, when will we elect a woman president?
Thank you, Donna. Let me just introduce Cruz Reynoso, who is on the faculty of UC Davis School of Law and is the inaugural holder of the school's Bucheva and Byrd Chair for the Study and Teaching of Freedom and Equality. From 1969 to 1972, he was the director of the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation. He was a professor of law at the University of New Mexico from 72 to 76, and in 1978, the State Bar of California awarded him the Lauren Miller Award. Reynoso served as Associate Justice on the California Supreme Court from 1982 to 1987. He holds an AB from Pomona College and an LLB from UC Berkeley. And in 2000, Reynoso was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Bill Clinton for his leadership in civil rights, immigration and refugee policy, government reform, the administration of justice, and legal services for the indigent and education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all true. We've been asked, as you can tell, just to give a quick summary of the historical background, in fact, of the legal, economic, and social structure. And we're talking only about certain groups today. In fact, many immigrant groups have been discriminated against. They had to struggle to get to where they are today. And so I'll just give you a couple of quick examples. 1968, the Civil Rights Commission, U.S. Civil Rights Commission, was having the first hearings on the issues pertaining to Mexican Americans. I was hired as a consultant, so I traveled all over South Texas, particularly all over Texas, but particularly South Texas. I still remember Starr County. Starr County at that time was 90% Latino. Not one elected official was Latino. And so how did that come about? With a sort of intimidation and so on that we saw with respect to African Americans. And incidentally, it's often not mentioned, but the Voting Rights Act had as much good fortune with the Latino community as it did with the African American community in changing things. California, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which brought to an end the Mexican and American War, said that all Mexicans who decided to stay in the Southwest, that used to be Mexico, were entitled to citizenship. And in fact, the California Constitution was written both in the California Constitution was written both in English and Spanish, because you had Spanish monolingual Spanish speaking members of the Constitutional Convention. Nonetheless, within a few years, the legislature started passing anti-Japanese, anti-Chinese, anti-Mexican, anti-everybody except European laws. Particularly in mining, they literally passed laws excluding people from certain mining areas. And so we had a quick history of discrimination against Latinos. Then California passed a law saying that you had to be able to speak English to be able to vote. Well, that obviously excluded a whole bunch of other folk. And so there was a whole system, legal and to a certain extent social and economic, that brought down the vote of Latinos. Now we have the issue of the undocumented. And I sometimes only half-kiddingly tell people when they say, what should we do about the issue of the undocumented? I said, well, in some ways it's very easy. Document them, and then you get rid of the issue, right? I say it only half-kiddingly for this reason. Cuban Americans who come to this country illegally, quote-unquote, without documents, and their foot touches American soil, legally are immediately considered legal residents. And all this talk about a road to citizenship is sort of misleading. It's that what folk want is a road to permanent residence. And so it really is a legal and also of course a political issue of why we have the undocumented. We could talk later about maybe some of the long-term answers to that issue, but there's no question that's a legal and political response by the American people why we have all these undocumented. And so then beyond the undocumented, we see the issue in voting, and this has to do a lot with who gets appointed to be judges. One reason why people don't vote is when they think they have no choice or their vote will make any difference. In a municipality, if you vote at large and only 20% of the population is Latino and you're voting at large and there's in fact voting on the basis of ethnicity, Latinos never win. So then why should they have an interest even in voting? And that's happening a lot. That's why you file nowadays the civil rights lawsuits. So there have always been, sad to say, a lot of legal issues in terms of encouraging everybody, including Latinos, to vote. We also have, of course, the economic and social issues. All the statistics do indicate that the folk who don't have a lot of education, who don't have a lot of money, vote in lesser numbers, and Latinos in general have a younger population than the general population. So there are other reasons why the vote would be lower. Nonetheless, much can be done about that, and I guess it's for the next panel to talk about what can be done about it. But let me just tell you that I was long active with a group called the CSO, Community Service Organization, that was active in the Latino and African American and Anglo poor communities that encouraged people to vote, to register, to vote, to learn English. At that time, it was still required that you know English to vote, and eventually the California Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional. And so the CSO did all those things, and we succeeded in getting all those folk who generally have lower voting percentages to indeed vote, and were very active in the community. So we've had many legal impediments to voting, historically speaking, and we still have some residue of that. And we have the reality of economic and social dimensions to folk not voting. But even today, there are many impediments to voting. Generally, I tell people, and we were talking about this earlier, elected officials don't want more people to vote. They got elected by that group of voters. So they have no encouragement to encourage other people to vote. Therefore, it's up to local groups to go on and help, like the CSO and others, help encourage those folks to register, to vote, and so on, and to see that they're doing that really has a consequence for themselves personally and for the community. With that, we'll pick up with the broader issues in a few minutes.
Well, thank you, Cruz. And let me ask you the first question, because in that earlier panel, there was a sort of celebration, in a sense, of how much easier it is to get to register to vote nowadays. My reading of the history of the United States is one of that the struggle for enfranchisement has been equally matched by the struggle for disenfranchisement. Because no other country has all of these impediments in the Western democracies: registration, different states, different communities, different laws. And in Australia, where I come from, you get fined if you don't vote. They have tremendous turnout at every election. In the legislation for the creation of Homeland Security, there's a call for a national ID card. I don't understand how the same government that wants you to identify who you are would then not allow you to vote. And we live in a wired society. There's no excuse for fraud is not a problem. You have an ATM card. They don't steal your money every day. It's so wrought with falsehoods, this whole business of enfranchisement.
We've been talking about encouraging people to vote and the right to vote. The reality in American history is that there has been an equally strong effort to keep people from voting. And so when we had a lot of Italian and Irish immigrants, I remember reading that the mayor of Cleveland in 1890 was not a citizen. It wasn't required to be a U.S. citizen to vote. And then the states saw all these new people coming in, many of them who, even though they were European, they weren't considered white. There's a book entitled "When the Italians Became White," you know. And so then the laws were passed by the states, because the states are the ones that control this, that you have to be a U.S. citizen to vote. That was new, and it was passed to keep new people from voting. And that's been the history. All the proposals we have in Washington now about having people have two or three or two dozen IDs before they can vote, and they've got to register at 80 years before they can vote, and so on. Slight exaggeration. But anyway, all of those efforts are efforts to keep people from voting. That's been a struggle in this country. We can do a great deal to have more people vote, but the powers that be really don't want those people to vote. That's the reality as I see it.
Donna?
And women's history has an interesting place in all of this as well. If we say that the Jacksonian era in the about the 1830s is sort of the heyday of electoral politics in this nation, and we talk about that as a time period where the vote was expanded, especially for white men, there's an argument that can be made that by the time women got the vote, by the time the 19th Amendment gets ratified in 1920, that it really didn't matter. That politics was not being determined and elections were not being determined by voters, but rather by corporate interests and by money. And so what was the big deal to give women the vote? Because it was more symbolic than anything else, and it really didn't matter. And it's an interesting take on, you know, on the surface it looks like we're expanding the electorate, but that's based on an assumption that the vote matters. And in fact, it's very easy to give a group the vote if the vote doesn't really matter.
And Robert, you can get it. Next door in Mexico, they have a national ID card, like a credit card to vote. Mm-hmm. Why not here?
Well, of course, one does not have a national right to vote. The Constitution says your right to vote for president or for Congress is the same as the right to vote for the lower house of the state legislature. So young Jesse Jackson Jr., for example, has called attention to this in a series of speeches on the House floor over the years, calling for a constitutional amendment that would confer a universal national citizenship right to vote, not contingent on what your state may choose to give or not give. Jimmy Carter, as you know, monitors elections around the world. And he has said over and over again, if he was asked to come to the United States to monitor the fairness of a presidential election, he would say no, because he said the standards are so varied from state to state, and then within a state, that it's impossible with that kind of variation to know what's going on. I think there is this, I think it's largely on the part of more conservative forces who are now larger than the Republican Party, who think that there would be a threat to the political status quo if you had mass enfranchisement. I think they think, perhaps not correctly, but I think they think that if you had universal access to the ballot, voting on a Sunday, a holiday, something like same-day registration, that the consequence of that would be to enfranchise many more Democrats than Republicans, and therefore they are hostile to it. The social science evidence is not clear on that.
Could go the other way.
Yeah.
So, Cruz, do you think that there are any practical ways? I mean, one of the things that depresses me about this overheated debate about electronic voting machines and the possibility of fraud, which I don't deny, we all saw what happened in Florida, it adds to the reinforcement of despair and apathy, and it's a voluntary form of disenfranchisement. I want to find a regime here where people are inspired to vote, and it's incredibly easy to do so.
Well, when we did a study on that, when I was on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, we concluded that none of the electronic machines now are sufficiently protected. That if you want real protection, you have to go back to the old way of doing things, marking something with a pen, so then folk can look at it if it's challenged. So at least as of that time, this is now, I left a few years ago, maybe they've been perfected since then, but at that time, that was the conclusion. I noticed that seemed to be the conclusion of the Secretary of State and this state also. We ought to be willing to pay. They say, well, it's cheaper to do it that way. Well, we ought to be willing to pay to make sure that we have a good and honest election, it seems to me. And then I want to emphasize also that sometimes the sins of modern voting machines may not be the whole problem. We did a very deep investigation of the vote in Florida. And my conclusion was that election was stolen. I mean, that's a quick conclusion.
Not an inaccurate one, though.
Beg pardon?
Not an inaccurate one.
Well, that was just our conclusion. But it was based on the hearings that we had, on the testimony that we had ahead of time. I'll give you an example. The Secretary of State sent out a letter telling the election officials that anybody who was convicted of a felony could not vote in Florida. I understand that there were two appellate court opinions saying that constitutional provision in Florida applied only to those who had been convicted in Florida. After the vote, the Secretary of State sent out what I call an oops letter, saying, oh, sorry, we made a mistake. I can't believe that was a mistake. You know, there were just many incidents like that. We had Florida has the law that says that if you register with the Department of Motor Vehicle, then you can register to vote, and they send it over to the proper authorities. We had young people testifying that many of them registered in the DMV and it never got to the registrar. We also had the law that said that those convicted of a felony could not vote. And we had the people who were hired to put that list together testify before us that the Florida officials asked them to include anybody who might have been a felon. So the first person that testified before us, for example, his name had been struck. And he had been voting in that same place for about 20 years. He went in there with his wife and an adult child, and the people said, gee, sorry, Reverend so-and-so, but you can't vote. You're not on the list. Your wife and your son are okay, but you aren't. He says, what do I do? I said, well, let's call the main office. Fortunately, that was early in the process, so they were able to get to the main office. Later on, the folks were all clogged up. And he said when he called, the gentleman said on the other side, sir, have you been to a courthouse recently? And he said, yes, I have. He said, in what capacity? He said, I was a federal grand juror. He says, well, that's impossible. We have you down as a felon. He says, you have me down as a what? He says, a felon. It turned out that his name was the same name as a felon, but they actually had a different middle initial. Nonetheless, they had struck his name from the voting. And I've mentioned more than once that the officials there tried to make it appear that it was a mechanical thing, the hanging jags, hanging
chads
and all that. In fact, it was a whole plan that they had to encourage some people to vote, to discourage others from voting. That's really what happened right. In Florida in terms of our investigation and my own opinion.
The other scandal, I think, is that in 2010, 140 million Americans voted. In 2008, 140 million voted. In 2010, 2 years later, only 75 million voted. So this Republican victory was largely by default. What happened to the young and the minorities? You first, Donna, and you second.
Well, and Robert, you probably share this concern as we both teach young people on college campuses, and it was very heartening to see the increased political involvement in the 2008 election. And interestingly, when you go back even to the primaries in 2008, we talk about a gender gap, but I think what emerged, and it'll be interesting to see if it continues to emerge, maybe a gen gap of a different sort, a generation gap, right? So when you look at the primary battle between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, it was very much a generation gap rather than a gender gap. And the women that were more likely to vote for Hillary Clinton were women of a certain age. And young people, but young people got involved, and that was a very good thing. And I didn't see any level of the same involvement in the 2010 election. It has really dropped off. And if we do have indeed a generation gap emerging, it's troubling that group has dropped off. I think but when we look at certain issues, the generation gap's very important as well, and that's particularly with regard to same-sex marriage, right? And so it will be interesting to see how, because in California we don't just vote for individuals, but we vote on issues as well, where we'll go on that, both with with a gender gap and generational gap.
Robert has his response to why... What happened in the last election?
In 2008, something extraordinary happened, which is that African Americans voted almost at the rate of whites, a 1-point difference. That's extraordinary because voting in this country is a class-based phenomenon. So you had lower-class, poor blacks voting at an extraordinarily high rate, obviously, to elect the first African American as president. So we knew we were going to have a substantial fall-off, not only in midterm election, but there will be a substantial fall off Obama's second time around. The level of enthusiasm second time around will not be as great. Midterm elections, one of the reasons voting is less in the United States, ironically, is that we have too many elections. That is, we have an election someplace almost every year. There's always election fatigue. And this midterm election, what is the purpose of a midterm election when the man is just beginning, getting started here? So I think this was an inevitability. And lastly, it's always easier to get people to vote against something rather than for something. And the Republicans were much more enthusiastic because they were against Obama and what he had done than were Democrats in favor of what he had done. They were in favor of it, but that was not the kind of enthusiasm generated by people who think that something is going badly wrong. That brought out Democrats against Bush in 2008, and it brought out Republicans against Obama in 2010. And it kind of remains to be seen what will happen in 2012 in terms of whether Obama can generate that kind of enthusiasm or whether you have people voting against again, which always gives more enthusiasm to the againers than the fours, if you put it that way.
Do you have a quick...
I was just going to say that I had thought that after what happened in Florida, the Democrats, and particularly the African Americans, would be so mad that they would all get out at the next election and really vote so they could show those folk, In fact, the vote went down, So it's just interesting. Folk don't react the way I do, and people get discouraged very, very quickly, and that might happen again.
Sarah, you have a question.
Oh, I have more than one, Ian.
Well. Hi, I'm Sarah Pillsbury from the California Participation Project, and I first of all would like to take issue with you, Ian. I think that when you talk about the two big events that have happened, I think that it's hard to narrow it down to two big events, and I certainly think we have to say that one of the big events in the last years was the election of an African-American president, and that's a game changer forever, I think. I wanted to address an issue that you were bringing up. We talked about it earlier this morning about Citizens United, but you're speaking further. You're going back in history to 1920, saying that even back then, the power of the corporations and money was a factor. And I'd love to have you elaborate on that. And I also, Robert, I wanted to get a clarification from you in terms of the felony disenfranchisement as to kind of which sort of how that arose when that arose, and just a little bit of background in that area. I'd love to hear about that as well. Thank you.
Well, historians are ever pushing things back further, and I'll push it back further into the 19th century in California and talk about the Big Four: Crocker, Hopkins, Stanford, and Huntington, Collis Huntington. And our 1879 Constitution in California is a product of an attempt to get out from under corporate control of politics, even back then. Love it or hate it, there's pluses and minuses of the 79 Convention. One of the huge minuses being that the convention arises at the time of the height of anti-Chinese sentiment in California, and our Constitution definitely reflects that. But this was an effort to get out from under corporate control. It doesn't entirely work. And so what's our progressive era effort in California? The initiative and referendum system. I always like to think that Hiram Johnson is spinning in his grave today, seeing what has happened and the co-optation that corporate interests have been able to make of that process. And interesting talks a couple of years ago about calling a new constitutional convention in California that didn't get very much traction. There wasn't a lot of money that was poured into it. It started out promising, but it petered out. And we're very much afraid as a state, I think, and across the country, of doing what constitutional conventions do, and that is putting everything on the table. So I think that the history goes back further, and it's always been an attempt to get out from under corporate control, and perhaps that's what makes the Citizens United decision so much more dangerous, that it isn't like the day before Citizens United, our elections weren't corporate controlled, and the next day they were. This is just increasing corporate control.
Robert? As I understand it, that history is kind of murky. The persons who are trying to make the case that felony disenfranchisement, because of its disparate impact on African Americans, is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, are trying to also argue historically that it came about as post-enfranchisement of blacks as a means to accomplish what the law would not otherwise allow them to accomplish. But I'm not persuaded that the historical evidence is as clear on that as they would augur. That I think there were some sentiments outside of the South. I'm not sure of this, but I think there were some sentiments outside of the Southern states to disenfranchise persons as part of the punishment, as a kind of civic killing, so to speak. And I had a student a couple of years ago in a seminar make an inquiry into this, as to what extent is this kind of civic death characteristic of other Western democracies. And as best he could tell, it was not the case, that one did not, once one was convicted of a crime, had served one's time, then one regained civic life if, in fact, it was lost as a consequence. So I'm not sure what that actual history is, and people are working on it because they're trying to make the case to the courts that there is a relationship between the adoption of these felony disenfranchisements and an effort to disenfranchise newly enfranchised blacks. If they can make that historical case, that would be very compelling evidence for the court to consider.
You saw that there was that brief victory, which was quickly overturned, at a New York court where they actually said that you shouldn't be disenfranchised when you go to prison.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah. Because it was so clearly who was going to prison was so clearly a particular class of people.
Yes.
That was a violation of civil rights, and it was quickly overturned.
Yes.
So you have a question, Molly.
My name is Ole Kagan. I'm here as a private citizen, but I'm a public librarian. And so I've really enjoyed your panel, but I'm sort of disappointed that nobody's come up with any role models. So I think it really is important for people to be able to see people doing it right.
Well,
so
give us a suggestion, though, because we would love to.
Well, you mentioned Barack Obama and Michelle Obama; they're good examples. But there are examples. For example, Dennis Kucinich has disagreed. You know, Lieberman is independent. No, who are good examples? You know, you're the panelists. Who are good examples of? You are experts.
Are you a music fan?
I am.
Listen to popular music?
Sure.
Are there any persons in that venue who say things to you beyond their music or in their music that provides a role model for politics?
Lupe Fiasco.
Hmm?
The rapper Lupe Fiasco?
Mm-hmm.
He's a good rapper.
And does he speak to you politically in his music or beyond his music?
He has interesting political opinions. I don't know if I agree with him on everything that he says, but I listen to him, and he's interesting.
He would not be a role model for you.
He could be a role model. I don't know if he would be a role model for me, but he could be a role model. So that's one example.
I think we've been asked to...
Go ahead.
To speak of public role models. In fact, there are tons of role models in our lives, our teachers, our parents, and so on, and those are the people that inspired me.
Maybe we should talk about those people more, you know, in the public light.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your questions. Thank all of you for coming here today. And thank our panel here today, Donna, Robert, and Cruz. And there'll be a subsequent panel following on from us. Although we jumped away from history, didn't we?
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.